Yeah, it was a long time coming, and I guess there was a lot of question as to how the games that he won, you know, during the years that everybody was at war, so it doesn't really make any difference. You know, he still came out very well, and I'm happy for him.
He signed you, right?
Yes. Don Newalzer and Lou DiNunzio were the prime factors in re-signing with the Baltimore Orioles.
Was being part of the Kitty Corps a blessing for you? All you guys being together in the same boat?
Well, actually, what Paul Richards did was change the face of baseball. And the reason being is that when you sign the contract, normally you go to the minor leagues, and if you're good enough, maybe in 3 or 4 or 5 years, you were called up to the major leagues. What Richards did was really revolutionize the whole game of baseball by the fact that you don't have to go to the minors for 3, 4, 5, or 6 years. You actually, if you're good, you can play in the major leagues right out of high school and college. So Bob revolutionized the way of thinking of baseball. As a matter of fact, when I signed my contract and I stayed with the Orioles, all my teammates were very jealous of me. I hated the fact that I was with the Orioles, and these guys had to play 4, 5, 6 years in the minor leagues before they had a chance to come up, and here I am, 18 years old, playing in the majors. And
that much? 3 games in the minors.
My teammates were very jealous of me. So Paul Richards had a lot to do with changing the game of baseball, totally.
Did he protect your arms at all? Some of the guys came down with arm troubles, although you didn't really, right? But Barber and Estrada did. And
the first year I was with the Orioles in 1958, Paul Richards had me a limit of 80 pitches per game. And when I got to the 80 pitches, whether it was the fifth inning or the ninth inning or whatever, I was gone. As a matter of fact, one guy was pitching a shutout, and I get in the ninth inning, I got the 80 pitches, and out he came, and I said, if you take one step closer, I said, I'm going to throw the ball at you. And he said, well, you know the deal we got. He said, you know, I don't want to hurt you. And he took me out of the game.
Really?
Yeah, so I think that was really the turning point of my career as far as what Paul Richards did for me in protecting my arm. And it worked out very well when you look at cases such as Mark Fittrich with the Tigers. He was such a crazy guy, and every time he pitched, he had 45,000-50,000 people in the stadium. And but what they did is pitch the kid every 4 days, and his arm couldn't take it, and it burned him out. And after 3 or 4 years, he was no longer in the major leagues, and it's sad because the kid had a lot of talent. But he wasn't utilized the same way I was, and it destroyed his career.
Yeah, Wally Bunker, Palmer came along, and they were put right in there as teenagers too.
Actually, Palmer's a little different. Palmer, I was just before I got traded. Palmer kept complaining that he had pain in his shoulder, and he went to every doctor they had in Baltimore, and nobody believed him, and the doctor said there was nothing wrong with him, and they felt Jim Palmer was jaking, and he was a kid that was obviously turned out to be a Hall of Fame pitcher, but the front office or the doctors in Baltimore didn't believe that the guy had something wrong with him. And I was the only guy that really stuck up for him and believed in him. Finally, they sent him out to L.A. Not Dr. Job. He preceded the L.A. doctor before Dr. Job.
Curlin.
And Curlin did find something in his shoulder. And nobody else could find it, but Curlin did. And because of that, Jim Palmer turned out to be a Hall of Fame pitcher.
It was, from the reading I've done, it was much more common back in the 60s for teams not to believe that pitchers had sore arms. That seemed to be a big problem with the Reds in the late 60s, wasn't it?
Much different today. You know, they're paying these guys $3, 4, or 5 million, and if they get a torn hangnail, they don't play anymore. The game's changed very drastically.
You were expected just to tough it out and go out there, weren't you, no matter what?
No, if you weren't, you were belittled by your teammates. I mean, they just couldn't believe it, but you weren't going to play. unless you had a broken something. You better be out there playing, otherwise your teammates were on your butt all the time, calling you a Jake and, you know, you're letting the team down and they embarrassed the living hell out of you before you went out and played.
Yeah, I looked at the Red staff from 68 and 69. It seemed like everybody had a bad arm. Maloney, Gary Monninger, Nolan, Arrigo, Mel Queen.
Yeah, the whole staff.
What's it?
And those were pretty good pitches on there, too.
When you got traded to Cincinnati, you took a lot of, you were put in a real hot seat, weren't you, because of the year that Robinson had.
Well, Robinson was very popular in Cincinnati. Obviously, he wasn't too popular with the front office, but when the trade was made, I didn't want to go. Matter of fact, I never asked to go. Steve Barber was the guy that really asked to be traded at the end of the 1965 season. He wanted to get out of Baltimore and asked to be traded. And I figured if anybody was going to be traded, it would have been Steve Barber, because he voiced his dissatisfaction with the city of Baltimore, the Baltimore organization, and so on and so forth. Very vocal about it. And I figured, you know, if there was going to be a trade to anybody, it would have been Steve Barber, and there it turned out to be me, and it obviously was quite a shock. And then getting to Cincinnati and being traded for Frank Robinson, who was so very popular, every time I took him out, I got booed. So it was not a very good situation for me in Cincinnati. I hated every minute I was there. Didn't like it at all.
Fans never gave you a chance.
No, did sure they? Didn't.
No. I grew up as a Reds fan. It was shocking when they traded Robinson. It's hard to imagine how you could have satisfied him short of winning the Cy Young Award.
That's even then, I don't know if I'd have satisfied him. But I'm back. About 6 years after I left baseball, I was managing a professional softball team. We went to Cincinnati and played, and I told my guys, I said, you wait until they introduce me, see what happens. And now, lo and behold, when they introduced me, they booed me.
On a softball team.
On a softball team. So.
Oh, man.
it was quite funny, really. And I said, why? And I finally told them why, and they all laughed. Even today, they still boo us, I guess so.
Made the mistake of getting traded for Robinson.
Well, I didn't want to get traded. I was really happy in Baltimore. I was living there and my family there and had no desire to leave. Unfortunately, as I said, Steve Barber was the one that asked to be traded, and I was the one that actually was traded. So it was quite shocking.
Well, I mean, that's how Kurt Flood felt in 69. You know, he
got traded from the Cardinals.
Been there for 10 years and had a business there and friends and everything.
Well, you're like a piece of cattle. You had no recourse. You either signed a contract to play or you get traded or you quit. There's no other avenue. And they had you lock, stock, and barrel. And the owners had their way for a long, long, long time. I don't quite agree with what's happening today with the astronomical salaries that are paid, because back when I played, you got paid on performance.
Not on potential.
Not on potential, and you signed 1 year contract at a time, and your salary the following year was based on what you did the previous year. If you had a bad year, you expected to get a cut in pay. And you got to fight like hell just to try and get up for what you made the year before.
That's right, and a couple of years ago, Mark McGwire took a lot of heat from other players for accepting a pay cut after he had an awful year. That's how it's turned around.
Oh, those days are gone.
When did you first become a player rep with the Orioles? 65?
64. Mike McCormick. Mike McCormick was the player up. He got traded. And I was the assistant. Brian Harris' job. Became a a very vocal pirate from that time on, only because I was trying to protect the rights of the players. And most teams that I was with, I'd say I was treated, I would say, rather well, with the exception of Cincinnati. A lot of trouble in Cincinnati.
Let's talk about a couple of those things. You took a lot of flack over a grievance on first class airfare, which in retrospect seems kind of silly. It was a part of the contract, and they weren't honoring the contract, right, by giving you first class airfare.
What had happened is that during the course of the year, guys would jump on the airplane, and a lot of guys wanted to sit on first class, of course. It was a charter, you know, there was no problem. In a charter, you sit anywhere you want. But on a commercial flight, obviously the guys who were playing every day should have had the right to sit in first class. These guys were the ones that were out there busting their butt, playing in 90-100 degree weather. Should have had the benefit of sitting in first class. And then most of the time, the first class was taken up by the coaches, the manager, and the press, which I thought was totally wrong that the press was sitting in first class. And so here are these guys, and here we are, Bucks and coach, sitting three aside. And I said, this just doesn't seem right that on a commercial flight that ball players are riding in tourists and the press are riding in first class. The press, radio, and TV are riding in first class. So I brought it up to Marvin Miller. And I said, I just don't think this is right. And some of the guys are complaining, which I think they have a right to. I think if the guy played 9 innings and they just got through done playing, would jump on an airplane, they should have the benefit of sitting in first class and enjoying it, having a little room to move around, instead of the press, radio, and TV, and the coaches and the manager sitting up in first class, and we're back there sitting three aside. So he called a meeting in New York when we got there with the National League, I believe, or the commission's office, I forget which one, and a member of the Cincinnati organization, and we discussed the situation. And so then, after the meeting was over, I said, he doesn't think anything's going to come of it, and I said, well, then let's file a grievance. So then I filed a grievance. So then the next meeting was set up in Cincinnati with Marvin, supposedly Bob Housen, one member of the press, and that was it. To talk this thing over to see if it can be resolved. And it happened, I remember it very well. Marvin came in the night before. We were playing a businessman's luncheon special, whatever, at 12 o'clock start. They were meeting like at 10 o'clock in the morning. And I said to Marvin the night before, I said, am I going to attend a meeting? They said, no. No players are going to attend a meeting. It's just be Housen, myself, and a member of the press. Just sit down and see if we can resolve this thing.
This guy here, Pat Harmon?
Yeah.
A nasty article.
I said, fine. So if that's the case, I said, no. He said, this is the way. I said, that's fine with me, no problem. Well, Marvin walks in. But not only is Bob Housen there, but all the members of the press, radio, and TV, and they just annihilated him. So it was a railroad job by Bob Housen, a knife job. Here I am, getting ready for a ball game. I know nothing of what's happening. They're ripping me a new butt in the meeting about why I should even think about bringing this up, and so why they pampered the athletes and all this crap. I can't even defend myself. I was told not to be there. Nobody else was going to be there. I ended up finding out how the press, radio, and TV were all at the meeting. So obviously I was quite upset after the meeting, and Marvin told me what happened. out the rock. He said, what do you want to do? I said, proceed. I was in the back of the...
Ah, no, so you come for me.
Enjoy, Emil.
Thank you. I said, the fact that I got railroaded today, I said, let's just keep going, file the grievance, and let's go, let's get this thing resolved. So eventually they resolved it, and then if a player did have to ride into it, and this was changed for all of baseball too, not just the Cincinnati, but that if the players have to ride in tours, the middle seat was not to be sold. So if they rode through the cross, the middle seat was always empty. So the players, in essence, had the one seat next to each other with the one in the middle vacant. So they did have extra room in the back if there was no room in first class. And I guess the press was in, because the press were paying your own way anyway, so my question was, let them take another flight. If they want to ride first class, don't let them on our flight, take off on our first class. Let them go on another flight. Why the hell should we have to sacrifice for those guys? So then I guess they resolved it that first class was to be available to the players at all time, and if not, then they would ride tourists with the middle seat being vacant.
Gave you elbow room, it's not leg room.
Yes. Of course, I was chastised for that.
Go back to Baltimore for a minute. On somebody else's file, I can't remember who, but one of the player reps after you in Baltimore spoke about a player rep jinx on the Orioles, and they listed about 8 guys who had been player rep and got traded. Grabowski, Tickball, you, and everybody but Brooks Robinson.
Mike McCormick.
Right. Everybody but Brooks, who took the job, got traded. Do you think that was a factor in getting traded to Baltimore?
No. No, I don't. Again, Steve Barber was the one who asked to be traded, but I guess Cincinnati wanted me in the deal.
You just had a peak year.
I was the guy that they wanted, and that's why the deal was made. Because originally I heard that I was going to the Giants, and we were at the player rep meeting in Miami. At that time, the players met at the same time the owners met. So at the Fountain Blue Hotel, Lee McPhail and Hank Ball were coming into the hotel. And they said, hey, I just called home. I heard my wife told me there's rumors I'm getting traded to San Francisco. He said, no, we're not. All those rumors are false. Lee McPhail was still the general manager then. Harry Dalton took over a couple months after. And he said, no truth to it. He said, you're not going anywhere. We're not going to trade you. Forget about it. 2 weeks later, I got traded. That hurt.
Yeah, it's got to be traumatic, right?
That hurt. First one's always the hardest.
When did you first meet Miller? From 66?
Yes. Yep, and we almost made a very big mistake, too. And because most of the majority of the player reps wanted Judge Gannon to be the head of our association. Then we found out subsequently, before we made him the offer, that he was playing both sides against the middle. He was very friendly with the players. He was also friendly with the owners. And making deals on the side to pacify the owners as well as doing the same thing to us. What would have been just one horrible setback for the players if in fact we would have hired Judge Gannon.
I talked to Bob Friend last week, and he was one of the ones most vocal.
He wanted Gannon.
Yeah. Said he realized after he talked to Miller that he was the man.
Gannon was the number one guy. He was the guy that were going to vote on to hire. Then we found out subsequently that, as I said, that he was playing both ends against the middle. And thank God it was the...
Which you have been all along, really, right?
Yes.
Don't rock the boat.
Oh, yeah, you know, we'll get you what you want. But, you know, you got to relinquish this to get this and so on. So, hell of a politician. But Marvin turned out to be a gold mine. Marvin was a very unique individual. For a fierce, tough negotiator, he was the calmest, least talkative. But what Marvin did, I guess it's hard to explain in words what I mean, because I was in so many meetings with Marvin during negotiations against the, you know, I mean, on the other side of the table were the owners, or owners' representatives. But he was just so even-tempered, even. Never, nothing much wild. But he knew what he was doing. I mean, he was that sure that, he says, you don't get anything by yelling. So you get somewhere by talking over your differences, laying out what you want, what you can get, and seeking to go get it. He says, raising hell at somebody doesn't get you anything. I said, well, I hope you know what you're doing. I said, because you're not dealing with your normal type of negotiators. You're dealing with very strange people. And then he laughed. After the first meeting, come over to you. Boy, you're right. We'll come in on Tuesday. And Bowie Kuhn was the National League attorney. Warren Giles was there. Joe Cronin. And the American League counsel, I don't remember what his name was.
Sandy Haddon.
And they come in on Tuesday and we'd be talking. And they say, okay, we're going to give you $15 a day of meal money. Is that a fact? Yes, it's a fact. And we talk about other things. Wednesday morning, come back to the meeting, he says, well, the $18 a day we gave you yesterday is no longer on the table. And Marvin would sit there in total amazement and say, how do you expect to bargain? That's not the way you bargain. At least that's not the way I bargain. When I'm sitting with a steel negotiator, you put something on the table, it's accepted or rejected. You don't come back the next day and take it away. And Marvin was astonished by the way these people handle these things. He says, you can't do that. You can't bring something up on Tuesday, give it to us and take it away on Wednesday. He was just totally dumbfounded. That was his first meeting with the people. I said, Marvin, this is the way it's been going on for years. He said, this is crazy. I said, what's you're dealing with these type of people? They do this all the time, they do all the time. He said, boy, if I got my work cut off on me, yes, you do, my friend. He said, I think you're going to do very well. But he would talk quietly, put on the table what we wanted. This is what we want. They come back. No, we can't do this, this, and this. Can you do this, this, and this? But he never raised his voice. But the cleverest, shrewdest negotiator I've ever seen.
That's something that a lot of the guys I've interviewed all talked about, is the calmness in the face of such absurdity.
But in the meeting, after the meeting, they say, oh, son of a bitch, hey, how the hell did they think that? I said, Marvin, welcome to baseball. He said, this is the way they do it? I said, that's my God. He said, they wouldn't last 2 minutes in the steel industry or any other industry. that's not the way you negotiate. And you get to a point where you don't can negotiate anymore, you call an arbitrator. That's, yeah, right. You bring that up tomorrow. See how far that goes with an arbitrator. And I wink my eyes. Yeah, go get him, Marvin.
I talked to Steve Hamilton yesterday. He said that in so many ways, the owner's representatives were amateurs compared to Miller.
Ran rings around them. No, we're not negotiating. John Guerin, we used to laugh at him. Okay, Aaron, another name.
Yeah.
Warren Giles is sitting there playing with his tie. Joe Klon is sitting there, not saying a word. And we kept saying, why are they here? Where's the commissioner? Why can't he be here? The commissioner should be sitting up this place. Well, no, not really. I said, why? Because you guys pay him, right? Then we try to, you know, okay. We'll throw another thing up there. Fire the commissioner. Both sides will pay the salary. Well, find a neutral commissioner. You pay the half, you pay half the expense. Oh, we can't do that. Why? In other words, what you're telling is that you want control of the commissioner. So it'd be obviously not biased with the players. I think so what you're talking is asinine. How do you expect a commissioner to be biased when he's being paid by you? Well, we could never do that. That would be the last time. We bring it up every year. Well, we can't do that. So the American League president's paid by you, the National League president's paid by you, and the commissioner's paid by you. Where does that leave the athlete?
With Marvin.
Now we got Marvin Miller.
It wouldn't go away.
Oh, he would lay it. You know, after the meeting, he would sit, go through his mind, what happened, bring it all back out. So this is the road we got to take. Tomorrow we'll follow this step to see where it goes. Next day we'll follow, you know, so you know, every day after the meeting, through his computer brain, we hash it back out, where he felt the strong points were, the weak points were, what he thought we could get, what he thought we couldn't get. But back in those days, it was all chicken feed. The basic agreement was basically that nothing was going to change. Players' contracts were just that, nothing's going to change. So really an issue where real money, living quarters and spring training, pension plan was a topic that was coming up more and more strongly every year. But until free agency and arbitration came in, there's nothing we really had to ground to stand on. Either take what they gave us, or you go on strike. At that point, way back then, we just thought there wasn't nothing there to strike about. And what Marvin did was obviously lay the groundwork to where the day came that the players finally had their say. And that happened after free agency and arbitration was established. Mm-hmm. But up to that point,
drove a little wedge here and a little wedge there until the opening could be made.
Yeah, as I said, when you sign a player's contract, the club owns you, lock, stock, and barrel. You had no recourse, no right to do anything on your own. You either stayed with that team or... So what could we fight for in our basic agreement? Because we had nothing to stand. We had nothing to stand at. That was it. And then after we hired Marvin